I'm calling all senators. Calling all senators, members of the Human Services Committee. Get down here, Ben Westland and Dr. Bates. Get here. Thanks. Work that we're going to do on any bill will pass at that time. So the Senate Special Committee on Budget, Subcommittee on Human Services is now open, and what I'd like to do is to have John to walk us through our first bill, Senate Bill 289, and then we will proceed from there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 289, you have in front of you a text of the bill. And you also have a staff measure summary of the bill. This passed through Senate Committee on Human Services some time ago and was referred to ultimately to the Senate Budget Committee. Senate Bill 289 would appropriate $49,000 general fund for the purpose of providing fresh Oregon-grown fruits and vegetables from farmers markets to eligible individuals through the Women, Infants, and Children's Program. This is a program within the Department of Human Services Public Health Program. I'm aware of at least two people that would like to testify on this bill, and you have their names right here, Madam Chair.
So let me call up Ms. Woodbury. Sue Woodbury.
Thank you.
Thanks for doing
it. Great. Oh, I heard my seat. I just called you over the microphone.
No.
Oh, but I heard it through the spirit.
That's why I was listening.
You can proceed.
Okay. Chair Carter, members of the committee, I'm Sue Woodbury. I'm Program Manager for Nutrition and Health Screening for Women, Infants, and Children in the Office of Family Health, Department of Human Services. And I'm here to testify and provide information on Senate Bill 289. The Nutrition and Health Screening Program administers the WIC Farmers Market Nutrition Program. The focus of the Farmer Market Nutrition Program is to encourage participants to purchase fresh fruits and vegetables. From June through October, we provide checks worth $20 for WIC participants to be used at local farmers markets to purchase fresh fruits and vegetables. The program has been in operation for 9 years and has been very successful in encouraging the use of fresh fruits and vegetables. Additional funds allocated would have a large impact on WIC participants because it would mean that more families would be able to purchase fresh fruits and vegetables from local farmers at farmers markets and farm stands. Not only would this mean better nutrition for women and children, it encourages participants to continue to purchase fresh fruits and vegetables locally on an ongoing basis. The farmers report that the WIC Farmers Market Program is a benefit to them, and 90% indicate that they would recommend the program to fellow farmers. With Oregon being among the top states in hunger in the nation, the opportunity to provide additional funds for food would be very beneficial. These dollars also help Oregon small family farmers who in turn spend the money locally and promote the local economic development. While the department supports the concept of this bill, it is not in the governor's recommended budget. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Questions? John?
Madam Chair, just to clarify, the bill itself is not in the governor's budget, but there is funding of $49,000 already in the governor's budget.
Okay.
If this bill were to pass, we would have the conversation with the chairs about whether to retain that $49,000 that is already in the governor's budget and this. I don't think that is their intention, but we need some clarity on that.
Okay.
One of the advantages of passing this bill, however, is that it would move forward more quickly than probably the Department of Human Services budget, and these funds could be used
right off the bat in the next biennium starting July 1st.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Shields?
Thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak for a moment, Senator Carter. For the record, my name is Frank Shields. I represent District 24, covering East Multnomah and North Clackamas counties. Inside the city of Portland, I have to say, when I say that, with Senator Monis Anderson sitting there. In addition to serving in this legislative body, for the past 12 years, I've been a member of the Hunger Relief Task Force. And I chaired the Interim General Government Committee, which requested that this bill be introduced. Since the U.S. Department of Agriculture named Oregon the hungriest state in the nation in 1999, we've made substantial progress. However, Oregon remains the state with the greatest number of food-insecure households of any state in the country. I don't think that's one of the records that we want to hold up and be proud of. And it absolutely makes little sense, given our rich natural agricultural assets. Senate Bill 289 expands the Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program, which provides WIC clients with coupons redeemable for fresh fruits and vegetables. You know about the $49,000, so I won't keep talking about it. It's in addition to the $149 current general fund allocation. These additional funds are crucial, as they would expand the program to include roadside stands and increase the amount of participant vouchers from $20 to $30. When you're talking about low-income people getting fresh fruits and vegetables, that's not a huge amount of money. This relatively small appropriation will guarantee a two-sided benefit. And we talked a lot about this in our Hunger Relief Task Force. It's both beneficial for the recipients that are hungry and low income, but it's very beneficial for farmers who've been very supportive of the bill. The thing that's time-sensitive about this is that we're entering the height of the growing season now. If the bill sits around, if it would have passed at the end of the last legislative session, the growing season would have been over. You know, they wouldn't have been giving many people vouchers that would have been much good to them. So there is a time-sensitive nature to it, and I hope you'll give it your attention quickly. The bill follows in the footsteps of Senate Bill 500, which we passed last session, and would serve to ensure the continued success of a proven program that leverages Oregon's rich agricultural assets in our efforts to end hunger in the state of Oregon. There are several other people, including, I noticed in the audience, one of my our former colleagues, former Senator Ron Cease, is here to talk about the bill. So I hope you'll give several people an opportunity to chime in. Thank you, Senator Carter.
Thank you, Senator.
Madam Chair, among those other people, quick question for the good senator. Does Brian Johnston support this bill?
You know,
I mean, just inquiring mind.
When we served in the House together, I never spoke for Brian Johnson, and I certainly am not going to start now.
Good recommendation.
He was never able to speak for himself, so I'm asking you.
He was never able to speak for
himself. I'm trying to get some indication.
I beg to differ with you. I have never known anybody that spoke for himself better than the Honorable Mr. Johnson. Any other questions
Thank
that
you
might have relevance, Senator Westland?
Now that you guys have both maligned him.
But they're sitting next to one another. Is that an indication?
Former Senator Shreese, great friend, great former legislator, former professor at Portland State University, and a man who knows how to laugh wildly. Welcome, Mr. Shreese.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ron Cease. I'm, as you indicate, a former member of this body and earlier that of the House. As a matter of fact, I served on this particular subcommittee, but I want you to know I'm happy I'm not serving on it now. I'm currently on the board of the Oregon Food Bank, and I'm here in my that capacity. I'm chair of the Advocacy Committee. This little program, in fact, I introduced the bill for this program in 1995, at the request of the Hunger Relief Task Force, and at that time I was a member of that body as well. In addition to, I think, the substantive good that this program does, it's a feel-good program, a feel-good bill. For the small amount of money you were asking to appropriate, I think it would do an immense amount of good. Depending on what money is available, I understand that this additional, or close to $50,000, would make the state eligible for maybe twice that in federal support for this program. And as Senator Shields has indicated, two other features which I think are important as you talk about additional money for the program, and that is roadside stands are now part of it. It's not simply the farmer's market, and I think that opens up the program substantially to rural areas, and the amount of money that would be available for an individual would jump from $20 to $30. If you consider what kinds of food and support that WIC gives to young people, it's to a large extent, as I understand it, bulk and related kinds of food. The addition of some fresh produce has added immensely, I think, to the program at relatively low cost, and the farmers have been very happy with the program as well, and I understand that many of the women who come in and use these coupons at the farmer's market end up also using some of their own money to buy additional produce. I think it's a wonderful little bill with a minimum cost, and I would urge your support.
Thank you. Questions? You might be glad that one Mr. Weston is not here to ask questions. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there someone else out in the audience wanting to speak to this bill? Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Patty Whitney Wise, the Director for the Hunger Relief Task Force, and we are very much in support of this bill, of course. This has been an important program to us all along. You've heard the value of this program, so I'm not to go over that again. I'll submit some written testimony with information on it for you, and also for Noreen Goplin with Lutheran Advocacy, who had to be at another hearing. What I wanted to clarify, though, is that this $49,000 is in addition to what is in the budget. It is not in the budgets right now, but my understanding from Senator Schrader is that there is money available for this. We had two bills, Summer Food and the WIC Farmers Market, and in our dialogue with him, he agreed to move these forward with funding. So that would be an additional $49,000 to what is in the budget now. I just wanted to make sure that was very clear. And I think to be able to expand, especially into rural areas that don't have farmers markets but do have the roadside stands, would be very helpful for those WIC clients in rural areas. And many of those farmers struggle as well. So to have this added business really is helpful. We know in some instances that the farmers will plant the next year in part because of the WIC clients and the kinds of fruits and vegetables that they like.
So how does it work in terms of roadside,
The roadside stands?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right now, there's a separate program called the Senior Farmers Market Program, which also is a voucher program. Seniors get vouchers to spend, and they've been able all along to use either farmers market or certified roadside stands. So there's already a list of certified stands the department has certified, and those will be the same stands now that the WIC moms and their kids could go to. Often they're neighborhood stands. In our neighborhood, for instance, in Milwaukee, there's Justy's Fruit and Vegetable Mart. And he has always complained about this because it used to be he would go to the farmer's market with his produce and he could take the WIC coupons there, but they couldn't come into his regular roadside stand and use them. So this takes care of that discrepancy. And like I said, the extra money will really help to expand the program to more parts of the state.
So this $49,000 leverage, how much?
It potentially can leverage a lot of federal dollars. And the reason I say potentially is because, as you know, they're making some cutbacks at the federal level right now. Before last year, when they changed the law, it was a 30-70 split. So for every $30 we put in, we could get 70 in federal. They changed that last June. It's now at a 5.95 50% split. For every $5 we put in, we potentially can get 95. But they have cut funds in that program overall recently. So right now, it's not necessarily going to leverage a lot of additional federal dollars, but it potentially could leverage a lot of federal dollars if they put more money in at the federal level.
Other than Jesse James, I understand that Oregon had the disputed position of being number one hunger state in the nation, and where are we now?
We're at number eight. And in large part, we believe that's because of the expansion in the food stamp program, which has risen by 70% over the last 4 years.
That is nothing to still be excited
about. No. We have a long way to go. So this is a very small piece, but it does move us in the right direction.
Okay. That's a great question. Senator?
Do you know off the top of your head the name of the federal program that is able to leverage $95 for every five state dollars?
This is the only one that I'm aware of.
And the name of that?
It's WIC Farmers Market Program. It's under the United States Department of Agriculture. But like I said, federally they've been cutting back the overall funding.
Right.
Right. Yeah. But it could potentially grow.
Okay. Good question?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. I know there are other people here as well.
Please.
Thank you, Chair Carter, members of the committee. I'm Don Schellenberg, pleased to be here representing those who produce this healthy and nutritious food.
Sitting here enjoying yourself, Don.
My pardon, Madam Chair. And pleased to support this bill, recognize the importance of the program to women and infant children in particular, a very important program. And it, of course, does have the side benefits that have been talked about. We recently sent out to our membership an invitation to put together a list of farm stands and farmers markets. And I'm pleased to say that we now have published a guide for 76 farmers markets and farm stands around the state. So they are in abundance. They are growing. It's a fast-growing part of the agricultural economy. And we're pleased that we can be a part of that and that we can support this program.
So, Don, you have a list of those?
I do. Not with me, but I can get you. I can get them for you.
Can you talk some of those by my office?
I will do that, Madam Chair. Yes, thank you.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Further questions, Mr. Schellenberg? Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. Is there absolutely somebody? Oh, Ms. Lowe, we are here. I shouldn't you stand up. We know what it means.
Could we talk baseball for a minute?
Yes.
A minute, Madam Chair.
Did she bet on OSU with it?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, if I were going to talk baseball with Senator Westland right now, I'd be wearing black and be in sort of deep despair. But August will come.
Hey, half your team's colors, you know, are correct, orange and black. Half of them are doing well.
And as an Oregon alum, I will have you know that I rooted very hard for the Oregon State Beavers. Now with
the Oregon black guys aren't doing so well.
Now with the fact that my sports nut half of my personality has been put aside, Chair Carter and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, legislative advocate for the Oregon Food Bank and the Oregon Law Center, and I was actually chair of the Hunger Relief Task Force when we started the program in Oregon. And one of the benefits that I think hasn't been mentioned is really the habit then, a good habit, that many of these women and their children start, and that's accessing the farmers markets and the food stamps, because that's Oregon produce at its best, and it's nutrition at its best. And as one of those who does go to the farmers market in my neighborhood, I have watched the kind of relationship between many of the vendors, the farmers, and some of the families who are coming. and it is a healthy relationship, as they talk about how you do cook Swiss chard, for example, or some of the foods that may not have been part of their family traditions. But thank you so much for making this one of your priority bills in terms of non-budget bills before this committee. I encourage you to get it on its way quickly, because as has been expressed, the soonest that this becomes available, then we will have more people with more resources going to the farmers market. Thank you.
Ms. Rowe, do you know Brian Johnson's position on this bill?
It had better be supportive.
I think he got the message.
That's a much more satisfactory answer than that, Frank Shield.
I don't think so.
No other people dying. Okay. Thank you. Okay, well, we close the hearing part of this meeting and go to work session.
Madam Chair?
Okay.
Would you entertain a motion?
I will.
Do we need LFO to do any other additional reporting?
Could you stop asking questions and go for the motion?
Madam Chair, always being a collaborative individual. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 289 to the full Senate committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Westman moved 289 to the floor, to the full committee, excuse me, with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? Senator Mona Sanderson.
Comment, no objection. But for the last month now, Gresham has had its Saturday farmers market, and Fairview now has a Thursday night farmers market. And it's really a family affair also. So even though we're talking about good nutrition and we're talking about what it'll do for the farmers, and it's really a good family gathering, and there's lots of things to see, and there's lots of community and visiting, and I take my dad every Saturday. It's just a wonderful thing. But also we need to note that Oregon has the most small farmers, they say in the nation, and I don't know if that's absolutely true, and we are the one state that's not having the big conglomerates come in yet, and so this will help our farmers, and we want to maintain our small farmer market for sure.
You bet. No objections? Thank you very much.
I close the session and then go on.
Okay, we'll close the work session on 289 and open the session on Senate Bill 88. Mr. Britton?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a summary of some material related to Senate Bill 88 that I'd like to hand out to you.
Okay. You know, while you handed that out, I mean, even a Big Mac truck can drop through, can run through this, this relating clause, Mr. Britton. Even Ben might try to put some legislation in this one.
I already have, Madam Chair. I have the amendments.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's right, we're living between two houses.
I know, it's terrible.
Thank you, Mr. Britton.
Madam Chair, I'd like to point out a few things in this summary. This was a summary that the Department of Human Services put together back for a May 9th hearing before the House Budget Committee. It was an informational meeting that was a discussion of the Medicare Modernization Act, not specifically Senate Bill 88.
Okay.
But there is good information in here on Senate Bill 88, and it may be somewhat redundant because Mr. Johnston and Dr. Kitchen will be talking about Senate Bill 88 in a moment, and they may have some similar materials. I want to go through this rather rapidly. Most of you know about the Medicare Modernization Act and the fact that one of the things that it does, perhaps the most important thing that it does, is to establish Part D for the Medicare program. Part D will provide a prescription drug benefit, and among those for whom it will provide a prescription drug benefit are both Medicare recipients and some Medicaid clients as well, those who are duly eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. On the first page, the second bullet is a key point and one of the reasons that we're talking about Senate Bill 88, and that is that Oregon will no longer obtain federal match for medications for duly eligible clients. As you know, we now provide a prescription drug benefit through the Medicaid program. It's funded at about 61% federal funds, the rest general funds and other state funds. This would, under the Medicare Modernization Act, end. And if Oregon was to continue its current practice, that benefit under Medicaid would be a 100% general fund program. If you keep going, you turn the page over, and there's a discussion of two policy packages within the Department of Human Services budget. One is Policy Package 110, which implements the Medicare Modernization Act. You can see its general fund cost, and this is, by the way, before the DHS reshoot, $132.6 million general fund.
Wow.
And then if you turn the page, you'll see a discussion of Policy Package 111, which is really the fiscal impact, at least the estimated fiscal impact, of Senate Bill 88 as it was put together for the governor's recommended budget, a savings of approximately $130 million general fund. So you see how critical this particular bill is. What is being contemplated under Senate Bill 88 is the elimination of the Medicaid the requirement under state law of the Medicaid requirement to provide a prescription drug benefit for the dual eligibles. You can see this policy package will eliminate Medicaid equivalent prescription drug coverage for dual Medicare-Medicaid eligibles when the Medicare Part D drug coverage begins January 1st, 2006, unless there are federal matching funds available. And there are some federal matching funds available for a few select drugs that are not covered under the new Medicare Part D benefit. States may provide additional drug benefits, but they will not receive federal match for these expenditures, with a few minor exceptions. Finally, in the last paragraph here on this page, current law requires the state to fill the gap between what the Part D plans will provide and what Oregon's Medicaid program provides, even though no federal match is available. And current state law also requires a state-funded drug benefit for Medicare, Medicaid dual eligibles who choose not to participate in the Medicare drug program. That is under current state law. So, again, the object of Senate Bill 88 is to allow the department to remove this particular benefit or this particular cost, $130 million general fund in the governor's budget.
John, one question.
Sure.
So where it says the current law requires the state to fill the gap, what is the gap amount?
Well, Madam Chair, hard to know because we're not sure how many people, if the state were not to take any action, if Senate Bill 88 or another bill like it were not to pass, it would be hard to know how many of those Medicaid persons or those persons who are now covered under Medicaid might choose to opt out of Medicare Part D. So I don't know. The maximum cost or rough cost is this $130 million.
Right.
But that's not specifically the gap between what Part D plans will provide and what we would otherwise provide.
Okay.
So it would be some portion of that. Going on to the back of the next page, I'm on page 2 of a handout that says Part D, New Information. Under a bullet entitled Estate Recovery, this is another component. This is not in Senate Bill 88, but let me tell you what we're thinking about with respect to this piece. This says the amount of revenue from estate recovery will decrease because of the transfer of drug costs from Medicaid to the clawback, the Medicare clawback. The clawback, as you'll remember, is the amount that states are going to pay the federal government as their way of participating in the Medicare Part D financing scheme here. Our clawback for Oregon is estimated at about $98 million general fund for the 18 months in the upcoming biennium. Currently, payments that are made on behalf of people under the Oregon Health Plan, as well as under long-term care, can be recovered from those persons' estates. However, it is the Attorney General's opinion that that authority would not continue and would not pertain to the clawback, which is not exactly a Medicaid payment, but instead is a payment made to finance the Medicare benefit to the federal government.
Madam Chair?
Senator Montefiore.
So are you saying that we would actually need to change statute?
Madam Chair and Senator Montes-Anderson, that's what is done in House Bill 3108, which is mentioned here. Currently in the House Committee on Budget has been amended to allow continued recovery of those costs. And I think the estimated revenue is somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.8 million or so. So this is not a huge piece, but where we're going with all of this is to introduce another bill through perhaps the Senate Rules Committee, and I've asked Senator Schrader to give us some help on that, in which we would incorporate both the Senate Bill 88 mechanism, or what we're trying to accomplish in Senate Bill 88, as well as what is in House Bill 3108, one of the amendments to House Bill 3108. Put those into one bill, work it through the Senate committee and on over to the House. So that's where we are right now, at least in terms of our thinking.
Questions? So, John, what I see us doing from here then is waiting until 3108 catches up with us and we can come to some agreement in terms of how we're fixing this.
Madam Chair and members, I think what we're going to do is try and get a new bill introduced
mm-hmm.
through the Senate Rules
Absolutely.
Committee that would incorporate both Senate Bill 88 and this House Bill 3108
Absolutely.
Into one bill that would deal with this.
Okay.
And, Madam Chair?
Senator Myers-Anderson.
So there's nothing, no action we need to take, but
Not
that is in going to be in the process. You don't need us to introduce anything.
Madam Chair, I not this subcommittee today. I will work with Senator Schrader and Senator Carter to make sure that what needs to happen will happen to get you a different bill. But I did would like, and you see I've asked some people to testify with your permission, Madam Chair. Holly Robinson from Legislative Council, who drafted Senate Bill 88.
Holly, will you come?
You'll notice that Senate Bill 88 doesn't explicitly remove the prescription, the requirement to provide a prescription drug benefit for the duly eligible. However, it does give the Department of Human Services a fair amount of latitude in terms of rulemaking to implement that kind of change. And I think it would be helpful to the subcommittee for Ms. Robinson to talk about why this approach was taken for Senate Bill 88.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Holly Robinson from Legislative Council. In anticipation of the question, I don't know Mr. Johnson's opinion. At the time, almost a year ago now, when our office began drafting agency drafts, the agency, as well as everybody else, was aware that the implementation of the MMA was going to be huge. But the promulgation of the federal regs and the implementation of those regs was really a moving target. There were a lot of discussions last summer about how to best approach this and whether or not the best approach was to modify the statute and include in it many very prescriptive directions to the department, or to give the department a lot of latitude into what those exceptions would look like. The heart of the issue is easy, which is that there's a statutory requirement that certain drugs, or that drugs be provided to Medicaid beneficiaries in Oregon. Clearly, under the MMA, that will no longer be allowed. But then the next question becomes, well, then what do you do? And with lots of discussion and the fact that at that point there were no regulations, the best approach seemed to be to give the department as much rulemaking authority as possible, in part because it would be better, would better serve the clients in the shifting universe, and also to make sure that the department would not be financially at risk for things that they did not want to otherwise be responsible for. So there was a lot of discussion. The agency knows in the years that I have drafted for them that I don't generally support approaches that really give them as much discretion as this bill appears to, because it I think, causes the legislature a certain amount of heartburn, and also because it's the legislature's job to really establish policy. But in this case, there really was, at the time, no way to really be definite about what the legislature was going to have to do other than exempt this group of individuals from state coverage. So at that point, the decision was made to go with this rule approach as we began to understand what the landscape was going to look like. A year later, with the rules coming out in January, this past January, I'm not sure that we have any more clarity about what's going to happen. There are the rules. I laughed when I discovered that the day before the rules were to become effective, they were already issuing interpretations of the rules at the federal level. And I think because of the possibilities of unintended consequences, because of the newness of all of this, I continue to believe that this is the best approach. I think for the program to really be implemented and to be implemented well, for clients to get the drugs that they need, for the state to not have unnecessary financial risk, I continue to believe that the position that we took about almost a year ago is the right position for this topic at this time. Certainly 2 years from now, if we ever leave and come back, we can revisit, legislature can revisit this issue and determine whether or not there's more of this that they want to put into statute. But I think that there are still so many unknowns, there are still so many problems. Enrollment hasn't even started, basically, for this population. And so because this legislature only meets every 2 years, and because the ramifications are so great, and because I think that what the feds require and how the state, what the feds require is fairly clear, but how everyone's going to get there is so unclear, I think that in this particular arena, I do recommend it as being the best approach.
Question?
Oh,
last
one.
Wow. Thank you.
Well, she already answered my big question. I do have a question.
I don't know the first thing about, Madam Chair, Senator Westland, I don't know anything about baseball, but, you know, I do know a lot about Omaha.
That's a good one.
This is, I'm trying to get work. Holly, first of all, I agree with your intent and the thrust of this bill. I think flexibility for the department in an uncertain regulatory environment is, without question, the best way to go. My question deals with, do you have any thoughts on reporting to the e-board? Is there anything you can put into the new iteration of this, whatever it becomes, a report to the e-board on this is what has transpired, this is how we reacted to it, this is the rules we are adopting? Would that be an appropriate paragraph in the, quote, new bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Westland, absolutely. There are a number of approaches like that that the committee can consider. One would be certainly reporting to the e-board and also to the substantive interim committees if this committee or if the Senate committee thought that was appropriate. There also are mechanisms both currently in statute and that can be modified that allow legislators and chairs of committee to receive copies of rules. So as the rules are being promulgated, the rules that before they're adopted can also be sent either to key legislators or whole committees, or there's some variety there. So there's also a way to provide legislative oversight in that way as well.
Madam Chair.
Senator Monifant. Yes.
I like that idea, although sometimes when I get those rules in the mail, I really need interpretation, and so I like the idea of having it be taken to the substantive committees during the interim.
I was just saying to John, I wouldn't want it to go to e-board, but I would accept it going to the substantive committee. I think that would be an appropriate committee for it to go to, and so that it can be fully investigated and could also give us a status report in terms of where we are. And so the director and the chair of the interim committee could work together and keep us posted on that.
I wouldn't be suggesting that, Madam Chair, except the director has been so evasive on Senate Bill 289, and we have no idea where he stands on this. It's just
thank you, Senator Westland. Thank you, Ms. Robinson. Mr. Johnson.
I saw you.
And Mr. Johnson, you should know that the chair of this committee welcomes you. And I have
and one of the members
a big hammer in my hand, and that anyone that gets out of line with you during this testimony, since you're new and serving in a capacity by which we all appreciate your serving in, will protect you to the greatest of our abilities.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we will do it.
And Madam Chair, members of committees, if you could give me personal indulgence, I would like to make two comments, if I would.
Okay.
First of all, I want to congratulate you, Madam Chair, for adding an entirely previously unthought of luster to Flag Day. And second, Madam Chair, I am deeply touched and at a loss for words, because in all the years that I have known him, and indeed in the years that you and I and he served together, I think, and I've checked my memory several times, and I think I'm accurate, I think this is the first time Senator Westman's ever expressed any concern about one of my positions on any bill. Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I may, I'd like to speak ever so briefly on Senate Bill 88, and even in that brief moment will exhaust my contribution to this conversation. As you know, Senate Bill 88 is absolutely crucial for us. And if not Senate Bill 88, whatever vehicle you create, this is one of those few times where a department can take a fiscal and run with great pride and say, if you don't give us this bill, we're short, $130 million. And as one who just recently brought the reshoot numbers in here, we don't want to do that. So I'm hopeful that you'll allow us the tool that this bill will give us. And I'd also add one other important piece, I think, and that is that the as we sign people up and as we try and get folks to make that transition, without this bill, people will not be as motivated to make that move. And this bill is an essential part of that transition. So thank you very much, and I now want to turn it over to someone who actually knows something.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tina Kitchen. I'm the medical director for seniors and people with disabilities for the Department of Human Services. And I thank you for hearing me one more time on this wonderful topic of Medicare Modernization Act. I think John has given you a very good understanding of why we need this bill. Basically, current state law requires that we provide a fairly expansive pharmacy benefit, and that benefit's responsibility is now pretty much transferring to Medicare for those that are Medicare, Medicaid, dually eligible. Without this bill, there will not be an incentive for them to join a Part D plan, which is completely voluntary, which would mean that we would pick up 100% of the general fund costs for those medications. If they do join a Medicare Part D plan, the way current statute is written, we would have to provide coverage for the non-formulary drugs, their cost sharing, and any other sort of out-of-pocket expense that they may have for the new Part D benefit. We would also be paying at the same time for all those who join. We'd be paying our clawback, plus then we would be strictly general funding all of these additional expenses. So having helped develop that $139 million savings, that really is a guesstimate upon what our cost would be if this bill does not pass and we incur those additional savings. It's very difficult to predict how many people would not join a Part D plan given the very rich benefits that they have versus what the formularies are going to look like. The other piece that I'd like to briefly mention is around the flexibility. This really is a moving target. It's a very complex implementation, and we are hearing new and different things from the federal government continuously. And just as sort of a really brief example, there's a requirement in Medicaid that we provide all medically necessary services called EPSDT.
What does that mean?
And actually, that acronym is more well-known than what it actually means. It's early periodic screening, treatment, and diagnosis and treatment conditions. There are a few Medicare-eligible children. So a couple of weeks ago, they said, no, your EPSDT requirement still stands and will allow you to get federal match. Just most recently, they have said, no, sorry, I interpret that the federal lawyers got a chance to see their previous statement, and we don't have the authority to give you federal match, and those drugs will switch out of Medicaid, and therefore you don't have to cover them. But that's the exact sort of flexibility that we're going to need over these next 6 months to 12 months as we start trying to put together a program that makes sense for people.
I'm appreciative that we're putting it in rule as opposed to statute, because you're going to need that flexibility, as was stated before. Questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Maya Sanderson.
Do we have a lot of, I mean, first of all, was the Medicare Modernization Act even intended for children? I mean, I would think that in the federal, at the federal level, in their wisdom, they would have differentiated that, but it doesn't look like they have.
Madam Chair, Senator Monis Anderson, we do not have a lot of children. There is maybe less than a couple hundred across the state and that are dually eligible. And honestly, at the federal government, this is such a complex, far-reaching change, and they are working day and night to put this into effect, and they're into areas that I don't think they ever saw themselves to get into. Medicare doesn't usually deal a whole lot with the populations that we do in Medicaid.
Follow-up?
Yes.
Would most of these Medicare-eligible children be on a lot of drugs? Are you aware of that?
Madam Chairman, Senator Monica Sanderson, I have not seen their drug profiles.
I was just wondering if this was a lot of money that we're talking about or not.
I doubt from the small numbers it cannot be a lot of money.
Okay.
But again, if we were to write the rules that would say that we will cover them with at a certain level, we would be we would need to change those rules as we get different guidance.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Understand others would like to speak on Senate Bill 88. I'd like to call Tom Holt.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. We would certainly concur with the thrust of Senate Bill 88 that the department is going to need flexibility in implementing this. Since the rules came out, I think we've gone from maybe every day learning something new to maybe every week learning something new about how Medicare Modernization Act is going to be implemented. In conversations with RDHS as well as CMS at the federal level. But I wanted to underscore something you have in your packet on the safety plan concepts. This deals with two factors. One is an oops factor, which we think that you need to take very, very seriously. While we've not seen an agency like CMS move as quickly and really quite as well in terms of answering questions as they've come up before, it's pretty clear that it's likely that there are going to be problems when we get to January 1st of people actually getting properly enrolled. There will be paperwork mess-ups. It's, just inevitable. So the suggestion that some allocation be made for that is very important. The other issue has to do with copays. We have, this legislature has previously made a policy decision about copayments for very low-income people in our community-based care, that they should not have copayments because, A, they really don't have any money at all, and, B, because it's administratively almost impossible for providers to collect them. These people are going from a no copay world in Medicaid to a mandatory copay world in Medicare. And under the Medicare rules, as we read them, pharmacies will not have the option of waiving copays, even if we financially were able to do so on a routine basis. So this is it will put pharmacies between a rock and a hard place. We will have people who desperately need medication, and yet we will not have an ability to collect a portion of the payment for the prescription drugs in an administratively simple way. Nor will nursing homes or foster care homes or assisted living facilities and others involved. Now, there's some mainly where Oregon's getting penalized here is we've done such a good job of putting people under our community-based care waivers, where in our program they are not subject to copay. One of the little complexity wrinkles in Medicare Part D is that Medicare is defining a long-term care patient for purposes of the pharmacy benefit as only those people who reside in a skilled nursing facility. So someone in a foster home doesn't count. They will be under the retail benefit for purposes of the prescription drug plans. So
Tom, those people that are in the foster care don't have any money. How are they getting drugs?
Chair Carter, today they get them through the Medicaid program, and they do not have copayments. That's a policy decision that you all made here, I think, in either the 01 or 03 session when that came up. In the Part D program, they will receive their prescription drugs through a prescription drug plan or a Medicare Advantage plan, more likely a prescription drug plan, but they will be subject to copayments for the most part, and those are mandatory copayments. They are not optional. And that's just a huge conundrum. And I think that at a federal level, there's some realization that a serious mistake was made in terms of how this works out in the states, but we're also hearing from folks in D.C. that this is not something that's going to get opened up this year and fixed at least this year. So at least in the short term, we would ask that some consideration be given to funding the entire safety package that's been put in front of you, but in response, I think this came out of a question in earlier budget hearings. This is something that's needed to ensure that people do maintain access to prescription drug therapy who very badly need it.
Questions for Mr. Holt?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there someone else with a burning desire? Of course. You do have a little interest here, don't you?
Yes.
You can come up now, too. And
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Carlson, representing Oregon Healthcare Association. First off, we're in support of the legislation, believe it's necessary that it's going to have to be enacted to comply with all the changes in federal law. But I did want to reiterate the comments Mr. Holt just made about the problems this is going to create for duly eligible individuals who are served in home and community-based settings. As you're aware, in Oregon, about 80%+ of all our Medicaid clients are served in home and community-based settings. So when the feds kind of carved out nursing facility residents and residents of ICFMRs, that doesn't make much of an impact here in Oregon, because the vast majority of our folks who rely on Medicaid currently for prescription drug coverage are out in settings like assisted living, residential care, foster care, and the others. And so the two primary issues we have, and they really get right to quality care, is under Medicaid, obviously there is no copay requirement. Under Medicare, with this new copay requirement, let's take somebody in an Alzheimer's facility that's a residential care facility license. They don't have the money or the ability to pay the copay. The prescription drug plan under Medicare can cut them off of their meds under that scenario. And so we'll be left with a situation with providers who will be trying to deal with some very serious quality of care issues and other issues that could result from folks not having access to those meds in those settings. The other issue, which is one we've been trying to get addressed at the federal level, is that the way the federal government's viewing these folks, they view them, as Mr. Holt indicated, just like someone who would be accessing their meds in a retail environment, as opposed to somebody who's really in an inpatient living environment. And so access to institutional pharmacy services is absolutely essential for those folks. And under the federal MMA, they are not including or requiring the PDPs, the prescription drug plans, to provide institutional pharmacy services for folks who are in those home and community-based settings. So I agree with Mr. Holt that at least the provision in the safety package dealing with copays could help address most of this problem. Some of it we are going to have to get addressed at the federal level in terms of on accessing institutional pharmacy services. But clearly that piece on the copay, which I've heard cost out at anywhere from $7 to $8.5 million, would be a very important piece for consideration. So with that, I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Question? Thank you. Ms. Zimmer? Good afternoon, members of the committee. Jacqueline Zimmer with the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. And first, I want to say that we really appreciate the department's response to this particular act. They've really done a great job of staying on top of it and trying to interpret it for us. One of our concerns in our offices is that we do serve about, I think, 75% of the state seniors and people with disabilities sort of make their way through our office at some point or another. Our offices, and we know that with this notification that people are getting, that they will understand that they may be eligible for low-income subsidies, and in turn that the woodworking effect will kind of start rolling here. And we know that that means that we'll be seeing more and more people in our offices. And while that's not necessarily a bad thing, it is, in fact, for us a problem when we think about the staffing allocations in our offices and the staffing reductions in the governor's recommended budget, and, of course, the equity issue that we have in our five large offices, where we're currently getting about 80 to 85 cents on the dollar to do the state's work for them. So we have genuine concerns about the staffing issue. And just for fun, what I thought I would show you is that if someone currently on Medicare thinks that they might be eligible for some further services and may be eligible for Medicaid or duly eligible, if they were to contact us and we were to travel to their home to do an assessment on them, this is the amount of paperwork that we take with us to do an initial eligibility screening for someone who might be eligible. And this includes income and their impairment levels. This is just the first step and then we'll hand them a list of a number of other items that they will need to gather so that we can take it to the next level. And oftentimes we'll be dealing with children of parents who get this notice about the Medicare Modernization Act, and they won't necessarily know where mom's checkbook, bonds, savings certificates, and so forth really are. So it can be a convoluted process, and it can take a lot of time. And we're sort of putting a pitch in here for a little workload simplification and a request that the committee, during the interim, look at some workload simplification items for our offices to make this process go more smoothly and just general business practices. And so I just kind of wanted to make you aware that we're concerned about how we're going to respond to these folks who we know are going to be coming to our offices and who we will want to help with other services that they'll be entitled to.
So this won't hit you until this act has been passed, like next January?
Well, the moment, you know, Madam Chair, the moment that the Medicare Modernization Act was passed, we started getting calls from people asking us to help them understand how this worked. And as soon as people get their letters, I think it's June, is it July?
Some letters went out to nursing facility residents already.
So as soon as the big first push of letters go out to people, then our phones will be busy with people who will, one, be confused about how this works, two, what are they supposed to do, and three, could we help them actually just with the applications in general, and four, once they realize that they're talking to an agency that helps seniors in long-term care needs, they'll be asking other questions.
So a person that is living in their home that is not in one of these facilities, they will call you. How do you help them if they have no money for copay?
Madam Chair, there will be... I'm not certain how we'll do that, to be honest with you. I don't really know. It'll depend on all sorts of factors that they'll reveal to us, and I'm not entirely sure how we'll do that. We do have, there are prescription drug assistance programs, in Oregon, and we do have staff people, and we do have volunteers who try to help people access free or reduced cost of prescriptions, but that's not a long-term permanent solution to the problem.
Those people do bump up against you guys in some way.
They most certainly do. They most certainly do.
Okay. Question?
Well, Madam Chair, having worked with families, and I've always have not been a proponent of copays, and I know the rationale from those people who feel that, yes, everyone should pay a copay, but when you are in poverty, when you don't have access to resources, you know, $1 to $5 prescription or $20 a month doesn't sound like a lot, but by gum, to these families, it's a critical amount. And I wish that the feds had taken that into account, but obviously they feel no, everyone has to pay their fair share, so to speak.
But that's some of the questions that Tom Holt has brought us up before us for some time. And the big pharmacists, you know, they do rote memory. They just do things.
It can work.
The small mom-and-pop pharmacists who've known people for some time let them escape on that. But that shows they are losing money over the years in their own businesses. And that's the concern that he has been having before us for some time. And so I think probably what we need to do is take a good look at how much money I see projected here, about 8.5, and then again 1.7, and for the cost of this is Part B copayment, yeah, and the other one's 1.7 million. So Benjamin, we have to look someplace, and I'm not sure how effective we're going to be, but we have to give something. We just can't leave these people in the cold. Further questions or comments?
Madam Chair, I just have one remaining comment. First of all, I believe, and I'm not certain, but we might want to look at what some other states are doing, but I think New Hampshire has walked away from the clawback. I believe they spent the money that they were supposed to set aside for the clawback issue and adjourned. And
Madam Chair, that's true. That's how they balanced their budget when they adjourned.
on the back so people have no money?
No, not paying back the feds, the clawback provision.
They ignore the clawback.
They stiff the feds.
Yes. But I think there is a hidden, cost here, and I'm not certain if it's been mentioned before, but we've had good practice at the concept of people losing their prescription benefits when the legislature eliminated the medically needy program last session, and 8,700 people lost assistance with drugs. And as you know, some of those people died, some of them did what they had to do with families and so forth, but a number of people then failed and moved through the system through hospitals and nursing homes and rehabilitation centers and so forth. And so we already have had a little dry run at this. We know what it's like to try to help 8,700 people get prescription coverage from some generous entity, and we also I think don't really factor in the cost of those people then while they're waiting to find the company that's going to cover them, then failing. Most of the people that come to see us because they're already frail.
So are you saying, Jacqueline, maybe I heard you wrong, there are approximately 8,700 people on seniors and disability who are without money to even pay copay?
Madam Chair, that is correct. I believe there are 8,700 people on the medically needy prescription drug assistance program that ended last biennium, and then those people then were turned loose, except for the people who took the anti-rejection drugs and were taking HIV drugs at the time, and everyone else was turned loose. And so we know that not all of them found a way to get their prescription assistance. We did what we could.
Thank you guys very much. Yes, ma'am. Are there others who would like to speak on this bill? Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Quick question for Ms. Zimmer.
Ms. Zimmer, would you stay, please?
Remember the Pontiac Tri-Power motor? Now the Audi Quattro. Are we making any progress on the Quattro issue?
Madam Chair, Senator Westbrook.
You know you don't have
to answer my car, are you?
No. I'm referring to really one of the greatest guitarists that ever lived on the face of the planet.
Madam Chair, Senator Westland, that is in progress.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Isn't that clear, everybody?
No.
Ms. McKeown, please go forward. Did you have something from Ms. McKeown?
No, so you're the only one that has escaped the retributor. So if you rest
it,
yes.
It will come in the appropriate time.
Okay. Okay, Ms. Ruth.
Madam Chair Carter, members of the subcommittee, I'm here to testify regarding Senate Bill 88. My name is Ruth McKeown. I live here in Salem, and I have become the chair of the new committee that was set up by the Department of Human Services to oversee the services for people with disabilities.
Congratulations.
And the people with disabilities have been very concerned about this Senate Bill 88 in knowing that it affects many of them. And it's a major issue for them. And because of their mission statement, which is to critically review and promote programs and policies within the Department of Human Services by advocating, protecting, and developing services that are essential for the enhancing choice, dignity, and independence for people with physical disabilities, they have made this a major issue for their committee. They have made it something that they want to follow through in any of their meetings and to have more work done on it. And without the passage of Senate Bill 88, the state would be obliged to pay for the full cost of the coverage of about 50,000 people who are called dual eligibles. And I think the cost of this is approximately $120 million for the next biennium. At this time, we are already cutting services in other areas for people with disabilities, and we certainly cannot afford to another $120 million hole in the budget. And we thank you for the work that this committee has done and for the people with Disabilities Advisory Committee intends to follow the progress and to be available to you at any time we can in working in this area.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Questions of Ms. McEwen?
Well, Madam Chair.
Oh.
I have it on good authority that Ms. McEwen was seen in the hall with Brian Johnston earlier.
Oh, my God.
So do you have an opinion as to Brian's opinion on Senate Bill 289?
No.
What were you talking about out there?
We were talking about the new advisory committee.
Oh, wow.
And he's just nosy. You don't have to answer that.
I'm at the bottom of this, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you so much. Anyone else to speak on this bill before? Okay.
Madam Chair and members, what we'll do at this point is to go ahead on the House Bill 3108 material and also on the Senate Bill 88 stuff that you've heard about. Put it into a new bill and get it before Senate rules. And presumably have discussions with Senator Schrader and others about the latest safety plan concepts that are listed on your back pages of your handout.
Okay. Thank you very much. If Senator Wessler?
Do we have any idea when these concepts will be refined and at least put into printed form? I know Holly already.
Mr. Britton?
Madam Chair and Senator Wesslin, pretty soon.
Before Fanny dies.
That's akin to Brian Johnson's position on 289. Okay. All right.
That will be it, but I just want to say one thing. And I know a lot of people walk these halls helping our most vulnerable in our society. But a young man that I just can't help but say something about is Tom Holt, who is very quiet and unassuming in so many ways. And even though I've seen the other side of him, I just really want to thank you for keeping the economic issue before us and the most vulnerable when it comes to our small mom-and-pop pharmacists. Thank you very much.
So.